You know,
but no one is recession proof, hypothetically. No one's recession proof.
No one's anything proof. Right. No one's your boss, right? Not like you or somebody saying that you like said the wrong joke to them in the, you know, around the water cooler. That's how long has been far away I've been from like normal companies. I still use the water cooler as a real example.
Yeah, I haven't been next to a water cooler in 4 years. Like
exactly. I don't think anyone.
I don't
ever
even know what a water cooler is, to be honest.
Yeah, we still talk about it, but no one's ever used it.
Welcome to another episode of the Board with Nelly podcast. Today I'm joined by Kareem, who has a very interesting background according to his LinkedIn. Nonprofit MBA management, master's in theological studies, physics and theater undergraduate. What happened here? What are you trying to be?
Yeah, the fine line between being eclectic and being confused.
Right.
I'm still not sure I know the difference between the two. Yeah. What happened? Well, yeah, I mean, I hated school my whole life. I wasn't very good at it. And even entering college, yeah, I would call myself like a late bloomer. I had no idea. Even going into college, I had no idea. I didn't understand the concept of like being interested in something and learning it out of interest. It's like, you know, a bad case of somebody who wasn't really well suited for school combined with traditional British education system in Egypt, which is just like harsher and more kind of dry than you can probably imagine most things if you go up around the States. It took me until my graduate degree to understand the concept of school. I was like, oh, you're interested in something. You can go to a place where a bunch of people are learning it and get into it. I was like, this is amazing. So after graduating physics and theater, just because I was kind of interested in theater and physics was just something to do that sounded serious enough for me and for my parents, I got really into theology and thought I was going to become a priest. And that's when I immigrated to the States and went to this school in Boston.
And were you finding physics hard or easy? Were those subjects a bit harder for you?
Everything was hard because I didn't want to
do everything, that. Yeah. Which,
yeah, it's amazing how hard everything can be when you just don't want to. But later, funny enough, the theology and, you know, I had to learn like a new language and I did, and I then later went to business school, which is, you know, some people think of it as pretty tough, but because I was interested in what I was learning, it just kind of like breezed by.
Right. What did you kind of want to do growing up if it wasn't a school, traditional school route?
I think at some point I thought I wanted to become an actor or a comedian, and hence the theater piece. And that was kind of part of my semi-religious revelation, or at the time I did call it a religious revelation. Right now I just look at it differently, but I had kind of one of those waking dreams when you're half asleep, but things get very vivid. And I had a waking dream about actually, being on my deathbed, and I had lived the life that I thought I wanted, which I had become a famous actor, you know, which is one in a billion chance that happens. And I was like, back then, like Jim Carrey was like the ultimate kind of ideal. And I had lived Jim Carrey's life, which was like, I couldn't possibly have had a better, other than being Superman. I couldn't have possibly had a bigger dream than that. And I was on my deathbed, and it was this moment, like right before you die, which only I was aware of. So I was lucky enough to be in a deathbed, first of all, and it wasn't some like freak accident where I just tripped over and broke my hip. But like I was in my deathbed, I had family around me. I couldn't see their faces, obviously, because I wasn't married yet. But I had my family around me, but I had this moment where I was like, oh, I know I'm taking my last three breaths. I can tell that I'm dying, and only I know. And even if those people are close to me, I'm so alone right now. It's like the loneliest experience in the world. I'm about to die, and even though they care about me, I'm the only one experiencing that. They're actually just having another conversation and chit-chatting, and I'm really about to die. And at that point, the whole actor thing became so vacuous and pointless. And I was like, what? Like everything I was dreaming of, oh, I'm going to be famous, and it's going to be money, and it's going to be this. And I was like, how pointless all that garbage is. You know, I'm going to die. We're all going to die, and this is entirely useless. So yeah.
This revelation, is this coming on a random night? Were you in a difficult phase in your life?
I was like really high. No.
Ayahuasca, whatever. I mean, yeah, if exactly, that's what it took, that's what it took.
All of the above. No, I wasn't actually. I don't think I no, I was too young to be. That was pre any drug kind of era. It was completely, I mean, that's why
completely
I
random.
Believed it was religious. It was just completely kind of inspired. Wow. I was sober. It was just kind of completely like spiritually inspired. Yeah.
Because if that moment doesn't happen, your trajectory goes completely different way. And it kind of came out of the ether. That's kind of
right.
Kind of crazy.
It totally came out of the ether. And I would have been until today, probably just like a failed actor. Yeah.
Well, maybe you would have been a successful actor. You don't know.
Maybe I would have been a successful actor, but now
maybe in a parallel universe,
what the industry's actually like. I'm not under any kind of like a delusion that if I had just applied myself, I would.
Right. Just applied. Yeah. That's what everyone says. Just gotta apply yourself.
I just decided not to, but it was like right there. You know, Hollywood was right around the corner. Yeah.
What was life like in Egypt? What was it growing up there?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, as a young kid, it was great, man. I mean, Egypt, the one thing that's really nice about growing up in Egypt the way I did is that, like, people in general, Egypt are much more socially available than my experience of at least people where I've been in the States. I know the States is not like one country. It's, you know, it's like 40 different countries. And there's
I'm from Canada originally, so I'm Canadian.
So anyway, I mean, I try not to make North America or the States too much of a monolith. I think culture is really different here, but at least the culture I'm exposed to here, people are just really kind of like busy and, you know, focus oriented, career and activity oriented, which is kind of nice. I mean, you get stuff done here and it's like really amazing place to be, but in Egypt people are just hangout oriented, which is really frustrating to work in, but really awesome to grow up in because people are always there. I saw family, I saw friends all the time. People were just always around and always available. You know, in my kind of early 20s, that started getting old real fast, and I started wanting something more out of life, part of the reason why I wanted to immigrate. But no, it was a pretty sweet upbringing. It was a good upbringing. And right now I view Egypt kind of like a little bit like a divorce. I totally appreciate who she was in my life. I wouldn't be the person I am today without her. I don't think I wanted a different way. Like maybe not everybody feels that way about their divorce, but I wouldn't want it a different way. I wouldn't have hoped that I grew up somewhere different, but I'm done. We're done. Yeah.
It's interesting that you had the opposite realization of what I had. So I moved currently to Spain from Canada, where I spent most of my 20s in that kind of like grind, get a stable job atmosphere. I kind of want to go to a chill place where like Spain is literally like Egypt probably vibes, maybe even lazier. I don't know. But I've never been to Egypt in one day.
they're definitely pushing records.
Yeah. Like they close the bank. The banks close at 2 p.m. on like a Monday. I'm like, what is this place? Like, how does anyone go to the bank?
Exactly. How does anyone do it? Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing where you grow up, you kind of want to go to the opposite of that. And your upbringing is in Egypt, so you wanted to go more like a hustling opportunity to grow your business, your portfolio, your resume, your education. So you went to the States.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like self-expression here. I mean, I know freedom is kind of like it's such a cliche, the word freedom, and it's like such a broad word. I don't think anybody fully understands what it means, but I have a sense of it for sure, personally for myself, what freedom means to me being in the States, looking exactly where I want to look, living the life that I think I can make for myself. There's definitely a lot less restriction, a lot more opportunity here beyond just kind of, I'm not particularly career driven right now or anything. It's not like that's kind of my focus in life, but I definitely think my life expressed itself a lot more aligned with what I wanted here than I could have done in Egypt. It would have been easier in Egypt because I'm like, upper class there, like owning class, my family support there, like things would have been easier, but I definitely feel more expressed here and more myself, and I'm grateful for that.
So when you finished your schooling, you were in the States, you worked in a lot of startups. How does one get into the startup scene? I guess startup scene is something that most regular people don't actually ever experience or even think about.
Yeah, it's interesting. All I've been thinking of is how do I get out of the startup scene? Yeah, how does one get into it? Yeah. It's interesting, man. And like, it's funny. We spent so much of our time. I actually have a really good relationship with my father, and I love him dearly. I mean, I see his faults and everything, but I love the man dearly. And he was a very kind and loving man to us. But he was an entrepreneur, like without thinking, because Egypt doesn't have like, oh, startup culture and like, you know,
Combinator.
Yeah. Like, definitely not also, but he was an entrepreneur. Like he left a steady job and all his family told him he was crazy for doing it and started his own company and did you know, succeeded and failed and succeeded, but he was kind of an owner. And it's amazing how much of that seeped into mine and my brother, who's my co-founder of some of these companies, blood, that without knowing it, it's just kind of naturally what we attune to. You just think of like, oh, I like this idea. Let's start a company. You know, it's just, I guess most people wouldn't even think to do that.
That's a switch. I feel like you either have it on or you don't. Some people are not.
It's on, it's like, it makes so much sense. You're like, why wouldn't I? Of course, that's the
right.
Like, I like the idea. Why wouldn't I try it? Why wouldn't I like go, you know, instead of like going interviewing for jobs and trying to find a job, I go look for funders and like investors and go try my idea. It's actually a pretty similar orientation of like, you have this, you're trying to sell something, but rather than just trying to sell yourself as an employee, you're trying to sell yourself as an entrepreneur. But it's actually very similar. It's not that different.
The big difference is the risk, right? The risk adversity is the difference, right? But I mean, I guess risk is a matter of perspective, because technically how I see risk as well, I mean, I see working a dead end 9-to-5 as just as risky as a failed business. I lose money, the other one I lose time.
Now that you would be let go, even from a large company like Twitter, you know, for example, even from a large company that seems secure, the likelihood that you would let go is, I don't know if it's just as high, but it seems to me to be high enough that it could create the same amount of anxiety as entrepreneurship. I'm sure failure rate of entrepreneurial companies is higher, but still. You know,
but no one is recession proof, hypothetically. No one's recession proof.
No one's anything proof. Right. No one's your boss, right. Not like you or somebody saying that you like said the wrong joke to them in the, you know, around the water cooler. That's how long it's been. I've been far away from like normal companies. I still use the water cooler as a real example.
I haven't been next to a water cooler in 4 years. Like
exactly. I don't think anyone's ever.
I don't
ever
even know what a water cooler is, to be honest.
Yeah, we still talk about it, but no one's ever used it. But yeah, anyway. But there is the running joke of like entrepreneurs are the only people who work 100 hours a week to avoid working 40.
Yes, that's the big joke, right? Yeah,
exactly. But I don't work 100 hours a week, but my job is with me all the time. It never leaves me. But thankfully, I love it enough. And the people who work for me and for my company, they do feel like family. And I adopted that from my father. They feel like they're my guys. They're my people. I love them. I care about them. I think about them as like my people. There's a sense of loyalty and like camaraderie that we're in it together beyond. I'm not always thinking of just like what's the most efficient, and I don't think they are either. And we're kind of like in it together. I just love that. It just feels like home to me. And I wouldn't want it any other way. I had a job a couple of times and it was actually more stressful for me having a boss, having that kind of figure that I'm thinking about like them. And every time I see their email, their name in the email, I get some kind of like panic, small little panic attack of like, did I do something wrong? I mean, it's
right.
Psychology. I'm sure not everyone's like that, but anyway, that was more stressful to me in some ways than entrepreneurship is.
I have a friend who actually has his own pizzeria business that he runs, and he enjoyed it, loved doing it. And I could tell that like he was something like really passionate about it. And then at some point he said, okay, well, it's doing good, but it's not really bringing me a lot of money. First of all, and it's also not good money on paper for a mortgage, stuff like that. So he went into an engineering job, went into some other jobs like that pay a lot more. But I know, I talked to him, I'm like, dude, like, I know where you're the happiest. Like, it's when you're the boss, when you can wake up on your own time, when you're running your shop. It might not be, you know, I don't think it's frowned upon in society. Maybe it's not looked upon as highly as an engineer. But like, to me, it's such a dirty trick and trap to fall into, to think about what society thinks of you as opposed to your own individual happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially now that society thinks everything of you no matter what you do. So what's the difference?
Right. What's the difference? Yeah. Just do what you want to do. Who gives a shit,
some
right?
People are going to love what you do. Some people are going to hate what you do. Some people are going to be awful no matter what you do. So might as well just do what you love.
What you love. So what was your first startup?
My first startup? Oh, wow. That's actually hard to remember.
12, 13 years ago? 14 years ago? I remember there was a YouTube video. One of your YouTube videos I found, but I don't remember the company name.
There's a Better Means. That was my first startup in the States.
That's the one.
Better Means. I had won that competition out of basically I won a business plan competition at Boston University. And at the time they gave us $10,000. And I was like, this is all the money I'll ever need to start a company. it felt that way at the time. That's even though I was in a business school and I was actually looking at numbers, but it was so much money. I was like, we could do anything, you know, take over the world. And Better Means was like, you know, it was just a really dreamy startup. It was my brother and I again. It was the whole idea was about how to integrate. It was similar to, have you heard of Holacracy?
No, I've seen some of your videos on it, but I'm not fully aware of what it is.
I ended up eventually becoming a consultant with organizational design, which is one of the jobs I held for the longest, or the one of the things that I did singularly for the longest time, and I love doing it. I love organizational design and architecture, but it was basically our organizational architecture, how to have a decentralized company, and it was our take on it. And it used software to back it up, but it was how to make decentralized decision-making and have a completely flat and decentralized hierarchical system. That was the kind of startup. That was the idea.
Within a company, within any company. Try to implement this within any company.
Yeah, company or anything else. Yeah, yeah. It's just like to completely decentralize.
And what's the benefit of that as opposed to a hierarchy, I guess?
The benefit of that is that, I mean, the pitch at the time definitely was that hierarchy does certain things really well. You know, it's originated from the Chinese military about 3,000 years ago. It's a technology, but it's a technology that we keep kind of implementing over and over and not rethinking it enough. We just assume that that's the way any organization should go. So yeah, it passes down information really well. It could be really clear on who makes a decision. There are other aspects of it that could be really efficient. And there are some things that it doesn't do very well, like, you know, allow for creativity to rise up or for the best site or for a meritocracy of ideas. And then rather, you know, you and I as coworkers sitting trying to convince our boss of the strategy, us just talking about the strategy and then the best strategy coming forward rather than one person being the arbiter of it. Things like these, you know, so it's like how to decentralize that and have everyone feel a full amount of like dignity and ownership of their work. That is, yeah, that comes out of non-hierarchical.
But is there a bigger problem with that? Sorry to interrupt you. Is there a big problem with that when at a much bigger company, as this is a big difference between big companies and startups. Usually at startups between under 100 people, you know, 50 and 100, you get some piece of the pie. You get some piece of the game. So you're more incentivized to really put in 110%. Whereas some of these bigger companies, they're not going to get anything but a salary. So, you know, you're probably going to be somewhat motivated to do work. But if you don't have a piece of stake, if you don't feel like you're fully involved from an equity perspective and then from an idea perspective, you're probably not going to put in your best effort, right?
I think so. And I think that's part of what it was trying to solve is that everybody feels a sense of ownership of their work, even if you don't actually own equity or a piece of the company.
Sure, sure.
But at least you have that kind of sense of ownership. You know, but it's really interesting. It's such a reflection of where we are in our lives. Back then, I was a lot more, you know, egalitarian, liberal. I was younger. It doesn't mean that everybody has to be that way. But, you know, they say if you're young and not liberal, you don't have a heart. And if you're older and you're not conservative.
Yeah, I've heard this saying.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I always resented that because I'm like, I have a brain. I am actually genuinely a lot more conservative now in the way I just see the world and think. I'm like, whatever. It doesn't have to be that everyone does that, but that's just my trajectory. And right now, hierarchy doesn't bother me. I'm like, yeah, hierarchy's fine. You can feel a sense of ownership even if you don't actually own something. It's by having dignity in your work and feeling respected in your field within the arena of your work. But that was just an expression of that time. But no, in my experience of Holacracy, and the largest Holacracy implementation I made was with a 800-something person company. That was a pretty big Holacracy. It's a similar system, but it's a much better known one than BetterMeans is and much more successful. And I still ultimately think it never really worked. The biggest experiment of Holacracy was in Zappos, and that failed as well. So
what's Zappos? I don't know much about Zappos.
You saying what's Zappos?
What's Zappos? Yeah,
Zappos. I'm not sure. Yeah, Zappos is a really big online shoe retailer. It was bought by Amazon, and it was like a very successful shoe retailer. And they adopted. And their CEO ended up committing suicide. It's pretty sad. He was like a totally kind of a charismatic figure. I don't know what the story behind it is. I don't know him or know much about him. But they adopted Holacracy. Now it was like the biggest kind of like loudest adoption of some kind of alternative management style in a big company that's successful. And it failed there. And I don't think it's ever really succeeded in a big company. Much to my dismay, I mean, it was my work for a long time and I really hoped it would and tried to make it so, but it doesn't feel like it really worked that well anywhere.
So what was the startup there? Was you like going and consulting for companies and trying to sell them this idea, right?
So it was actually a software, the BetterMeans software.
Oh, software. Okay,
they're open source right now. So it was the software that allowed people. So I was kind of the consulting arm and my brother did the computer programming for the software. And the idea was to sell it as a solution. And then later I became just a consultant. I managed a consulting company and we were like 1 to 3 people, but it was primarily me most of the time. And I was just doing full-time consultation around organizational development and decentralized management.
Gotcha. So where do you go from there in terms of other startups? Because you've done four or five.
And then I was part of Dev Bootcamp. Honestly, it's one of those kind of, it's funny when you were saying like, he has an interesting LinkedIn, whatever, like that. I was like, yeah, that's LinkedIn. Everybody looks interesting on LinkedIn until you talk to them. Yeah. I mean, the truth is, I'm kind of like given some leeway to call myself one of the founding members, which is a very broad term. But the truth is I was just there early on, but I'm not really a founder of Dev Bootcamp. So my brother founded that one, and that was actually a genuinely really successful startup that started that rash of like the 12-week developer bootcamps. And it's funny, like it became an industry standard of 12 weeks to learn how to code. When the reality is it was 12 weeks just because my brother who founded it like had a wedding to go to. And when he was making a deal with a friend to teach him how to code, he had to do it in 12 weeks.
So that's why the industry standard is.
Yeah, it's like 12 weeks to learn how to code, you know, and it was because he had a wedding. It's just like, it's funny, man, what startup culture is and what becomes like norm and what becomes like expected. And that just became like what the rash of like developer boot camps that launched from there. A lot of them are actually graduates from Dev Bootcamp. So I was in on the ground level of Dev Bootcamp. I was a teacher there. I taught emotional intelligence. We called it engineering empathy. I created a curriculum called Engineering Empathy where I taught about organizational design and emotional intelligence. And because I have the background in like counseling and therapy and like spiritual counseling, but also counseling.
I mean, there it is. Came full circle. Like there, you found a way to really implement.
Yeah, circle. Yeah, and I taught that for a while, and I was really into it. And you know, was on the team and started heading up admissions. You know, startups, you just do what you're good at.
Yeah, sure.
Place and you create positions where they're. And then we adopted Holacracy, and I took on the adoption of Holacracy. I was actually very resistant to it at first. I was one of the directors who was like, "No, I don't think this is a good idea." And then I ended up becoming the leader of it, which is, you know, goes to show I'm a man of my word. I rarely change my mind. I became like kind of the lead director of Holacracy at the bootcamp. And then from there, I spun off and just started doing Holacracy with other companies.
It's very interesting that, and I think in today's time, you can literally do whatever you want. As long as you're passionate about it, you can find the market, you can find the job, you can find the thing to do. Whereas this notion was so obscure, like 10, 20, 15 years ago, whatever, when my parents told me this and this, and like, oh, I'm like, I want to make videos. I want to do something like this. They're like, where's the job for that? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, as a kid, like, I don't have an answer. Like, I don't know where the job is. But they're like, okay, how do you want to do that?
Yeah, now we're the adults and we create the culture. So
isn't that fascinating, right?
Like, exactly. Yeah, I know.
You can kind of do. I do believe it doesn't matter what you do now at this current stage with internet, with social media. There is a market for whatever you decide. But if you decide to be really passionate about like a small niche and just focus on that, you can create a business out of it. You create a audience out of it. You can do whatever you want with it, right?
Truth. True. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, I like many other entrepreneurs or humans in general, I think, or whether a lot of people do or not, I'm not sure, but I suffer with sometimes kind of the fraud. What's it called again?
Anyway, imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Imposter syndrome. I kind of struggle with it sometimes, especially when I was consulting. You know, companies would pay me like $450 an hour to walk in there and talk to them about like this design thing. And sometimes I'd be standing in front of a group of like 350 people, you know, at least 80% of whom are smarter than me. And definitely all of them are much more dedicated to this company than I am. And I'm just standing there like talking at them and doing. And sometimes I just wonder how much of it is just me selling my charm. How much of it is just like human beings, we're all kind of fumbling around in the dark. And sometimes we find someone who's like funny enough and interesting enough and charismatic enough. And we're willing to just sit there and kind of like engage with them.
I've done some consulting. I know what you're feeling. I know what you're saying. Like you feel weird about, because in your mind, the knowledge you're giving is so straightforward because you've solidified it, whether through education, through life experiences. And then you're almost like, it's so common sense to you that you're like, should I really be like charging for this? You know, it's almost like you get this weird feeling that like, do I really have to like, do they have to pay me to tell you this, guys? Like, are you really, you know, that's the vibe I got from it, at least. when I try to do consulting for like video content for, social media
absolutely,
stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm just wondering in general about the cult of personality, you know, our generation now growing up much more online, having things like, you know, like podcasts, like video blogs, like consulting, like there's so much of that happening that our kind of natural charm and charisma, which was the thing that was highlighted most to us by in our generation. Anyway, our parents told us that we were amazing and we're funny and we're great and we're fantastic. And so we grew up with this kind of confidence and the sense of like, just my mere presence is like awesome, as opposed to my father's generation, for example, which is like, no, you work. That's how you're useful. But for me, it's like, no, I just am. Like I am. I'm the gift to the universe by just being, you know?
I am the product.
Yeah. I am the product, exactly. I'm what better product could you possibly imagine? Yeah, exactly. So yeah. So anyway, I definitely see it as a double-edged sword, but you know, it is what it is, and here we are.
This is life, right? This is the world we live in, and you utilize your skill sets in the best way possible.
Amen.
Moving on from that startup, where did we go from there? And I will get to, obviously, tiny homes, because that's what I'm most interested about is,
Yeah, Zomes. Yeah, so basically, from there, it was consulting for a long time. And then I was in Hawaii with my family getting out of the pandemic and the smoke in California for a year. And we lived in Hawaii for a year, which was like phenomenal time for us. And then my brother and I started talking about this idea of Zomes. Like, he had fallen in love with this material, this magnesium oxide, magnesium phosphate cement. It was like we wanted to build something on, because we live next to each other here in Marin, and we wanted to build something on our properties, and everything burns here, like just fire. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when a fire is going
right.
to roll here. So building something out of wood just felt so silly. So we decided to instead use magnesium phosphate cement, because it was like fireproof and amazing, and it seemed like this miraculous material. And we got samples of it, and it felt really beautiful to touch. It's like a piece of the pyramids, it just felt like
ancient
stone, like really lovely. And, we thought maybe let's build a dome instead of a square house. And then geodesic domes are notoriously leaky, so we thought up of a polar zonahedron design, hence the name Zomes. And then we worked with architects and created it, and that was 2 years ago, and here we are now.
What was this, your personal home that you were building, or just like
we wanted to build like an accessory dwelling unit on our property for our parents to stay at when they visit from Egypt.
So why isn't this material used more often, I guess, throughout California?
Excellent question. It's interesting. There's something I always tell people when they ask me about entrepreneurship in general or startups, and I say, you kind of have to be ignorant and arrogant enough to try something new, and you require both. You require the sense of like, well, people don't do that because most people would think, hey,
right.
there's like thousands of really smart people who are building billions of dollars worth of stuff every year. I'm sure they've thought of stuff, So I'm like, I'm not going to come in there and disrupt the industry, But when you're ignorant enough and you don't know, you're like, yeah, why not? I mean, people aren't using magnesium phosphate cement, even though we've known about the material. It's not like I've discovered
it. Yeah, right.
But they just, I don't know. But what you realize is people just kind of don't do new things sometimes. And in the building world, it's kind of hard. In the building world, honestly, it is kind of hard because everything has to get like permitted and re-engineered and rethought. We've spent $4 million in 2 years to get this thing off the ground. Which was, three times as much and twice as long as we thought we would, which is about on par with what startups tend to do. So it's been really expensive and really difficult to figure out. We've had the privilege and the capacity and the money and the time and the resources to do it. So we did, but it's definitely not easy. I could tell why people haven't done this, why people haven't done more dome buildings or a completely different building material or that kind of thing. But
what's the big hurdle? What are some of the biggest hurdles you're running into?
One of the biggest hurdles, for example, is we started out, the whole building was just this magnesium phosphate cement. That's all we wanted to use. And cement, so even though this is different than Portland cement, which is what you think of when you think of concrete, that's Portland cement. This material is different. It has different qualities to it. Concrete is amazing at taking like loads. So that's why roads, bridges, you put any kind of like load on concrete, it's amazing at taking it. Much stronger than most materials.
It's the foundation of everything we have in this world.
It's foundational.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah.
But it's terrible at flexural strength. So if you start twisting it or bending it, it immediately cracks. It doesn't like being bent or twisted. Steel doesn't mind that at all, and wood doesn't mind that nearly as much. But concrete really hates it. So we were trying to build with this concrete, and we kept getting, great on loads. But as soon as you put it in an earthquake, which I had to learn that what earthquakes do is they take a building and they shake it that way, which is awful because the entire load of the building is going downwards. So as soon as you start going like this, everything starts twisting and shaking, and that the concrete just cracks. It just wants to crack. It doesn't want to flex. You need something with a little bit of flexibility. So we spent a lot of time trying to research and make that happen. And at the end, we had to go with actually changing it to wooden frame, the structure having a wooden frame, and then being clad with the concrete.
Gotcha.
But that was like one massive kind of – but, you go through so many iterations because you're completely out in like, the Wild West. It seems now – reasonable in hindsight, be like, oh, we should just build with wood because wood is good at building, and then still clad it with the concrete, and it's still fireproof and awesome, and it still retains all of its glory. But of course, we thought of 8 million more complicated and less useful things at the time of like, we should put glass, we should put fiber, metal fiber in it, we should put this whatever, like we almost went to like organic material. Anyway, we went through a lot of things. Yeah,
organic
there were
material.
All sorts of options that were now in hindsight. I'm like, that was such a terrible idea. You know, it's the old, I don't know if it's an urban myth or if it's real about like the Americans spending hundreds of millions of dollars to invent a pen that writes.
Oh, the pen.
Yeah. And then
that's a myth.
Yeah,
that's a
exactly.
myth.
Yeah, but I like it as an example anyway.
I like an example too. I almost don't want to correct anyone that tells me like it's the truth. I'm like, yeah, it's 100% what happened.
You should though. You should. You should let these things get carried away further than they need to be.
Does the structure survive currently, like an earthquake or no?
Abso-frickin-lutely. Yeah. Yeah. So it's been like past engineering for like 97% of California. I mean, some of that 3% wow. of California that's right on a fault line. It's just people don't build there in general. Like, so, or we could, but it would just have to, we would make it so much more expensive for a very kind of small part that people wouldn't be very smart to build there anyway. But no, it withstands hurricanes, it withstands earthquakes, it will outlast most regular buildings. The vast majority of houses that you're around are, it will outlast those. Yeah. It's an incredibly robust.
That's crazy.
I know.
So what's really what was the first, I guess, idea for this in terms of price, in terms of your average consumer, stuff like that?
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, we were totally wrong at the beginning. We thought this was going to be a quick kit ADU. We were thinking like programmers, right? Quick, fast, we'll ship it to you and you build it yourself. Two people, not a lot.
Like IKEA. Like IKEA,
exactly.
Houses.
IKEA of homes, yeah. Which is still kind of possible, but it's actually not what people were interested in. Like if you're in that range of like, you know, the yurt, the $17,000 kind of like quick, fast yurt.
Yurt thing. Is like a tentish kind of house,
exactly.
Circular
it's
tentish
a tent
house.
And
yeah.
a house. It's made of like, yeah. I find them pretty hideous, but they're definitely like practical and easy to put up, you know, and they tend to be in the $17,000 to $20,000.
They kind of remind me of like those Mongolian old.
Exactly.
Like,
and they're made
tents,
of like vinyl
yeah.
and leathery kind of material.
Yeah.
So they're
yeah.
a little bit more robust than a tent. They're between a tent and a house.
Okay. I gotcha.
And we had our first model was 265 square feet. Actually, that was the model that was featured in that video on Freethink. It was the 265, and we moved away from that size since then because not just the vast majority, I would say like 99% of people who are actually interested and talk to us about it wanted to live in one. We thought of it as like
right,
it's a yoga studio, it's an ADU, it's an extra kind of like the way we were thinking of it initially, but the vast majority of customers are not interested in it that way. Most people want to live in it. So they want a tiny home, the tiny home idea or a home or put multiple of them together, but a lot of people want to live in it. So that really evolved and shifted quickly from this kind of like quick kit kind of building that you put up in a couple of weeks by yourself to a incredibly
a structure
robust.
That takes you a month or 2 months. Yeah.
It's really strong and right. outlasts your house. So it's actually even like more than modular building or more than traditional.
Right,
building.
Right, right.
It's a very serious structure and move to like bigger and more robust designs where people can actually either live in one big one as a tiny house model, not even tiny house. It's much bigger than a tiny house, or put multiple of them together and create like a home, you know, a 3-bedroom, 2-bedroom home, whatever you want.
Sure, sure. But I mean, I'm curious because I mean, you're trying to solve an area of the world that has some of the worst problems in terms of houses, unless you maybe compare it to Florida. You're talking about earthquakes, wildfires. You're talking about, I don't know, probably droughts coming in the future.
Shortage,
like, it's a very tough
permitting.
Place. Yeah, very tough place to
like
live.
Super long. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cutting resources. Not land is incredibly expensive. Very hard to find space for it. Yeah, a lot of. So if we can solve it here, we can solve it anywhere.
Right. I was going to say, like, that's a great battlegrounds to test out the product, right?
It is. And also manufactured in California is an awful idea. There's a reason most great things like, you know, the iPhone is like designed in California and manufactured in China. Because manufacturer in California has not like
right.
when you go you anywhere outside California, people are like, yeah. "It costs what?" Yeah, they're like, "Why on earth would I buy something made in California?" Yeah.
If you were to outsource it to, let's say, East Asia or whatever, how much would the price go down?
I could half the price.
Holy shit!
Yeah, easily with shipping and customs and tariffs, and that's after Trump.
Even with shipping, after all that stuff. It's still half.
Yeah, even after President Trump like raised tariffs against China with most building material by like 25%. And even after COVID and shipping and stuff is
like, that's insane.
Half, yeah, at least half, yeah.
Wow. I mean, yeah, any business or company that's trying to do stuff locally, I mean, you're shooting yourself in the foot.
You really are. Yeah. And China,
not monsters. That I'm trying to throw this in your face.
Because I've researched. No, not at all. And I've researched it, right? Because I've spoken to China, and they're just like this old kind of idea that, like, oh yeah, China, made in China, it's like cheap plastic, it'll break. That's so not the truth anymore. Most of the things most of the things you and I are talking about right now and using are made in China.
It actually is assembled, designed in Australia, assembled in China.
I'm sure it is. Yeah.
And it's one of the best quality mics on the market. Come on,
man. They're no joke. Yeah. They're not messing around. They're serious about this business, and they're not in the kind of like Western cultural revolution that we're in now, which is like, no, my feelings and my rights as a worker.
Right,
they're just like,
yeah.
No, we're here to do business, man. You just like, give me the design. I'll knock it out for you. Better quality, faster, no complaints, and let's go. You know, it's very hard to compete with.
What's the average land cost in California for some like these clients that you've had, you've built these zones on?
Yeah, the average land cost tends to be around somewhere between $300,000 to $400,000.
Wow, that's insane.
Very expensive.
And that's just for the land, for the structure.
No, not just for space, but this is like an acre and a half
piece of land
that people are putting a house up on. Because these like small lots of land, there aren't many available. At least not around where I'm looking or where we're seeing. Most lands that are available tend to be like an acre or so.
So it's on the outskirts of cities usually that you're these
are
being built, right?
It is on the outskirts of cities. Yeah, most cities don't have that much like raw land just sitting there. Sometimes there are, and one of the advantages of our structure actually is because of its uniqueness and its size and kind of how tiny homish it is, but more permanent and kind of solid than a tiny home, that it would start fitting in some of these locations where there's a plot of land somewhere in a city or in a town where it's too awkward for a house, but this can kind of fit nicely. And we're starting to look at things like that.
What's your biggest competition? Obviously, we talked about, was it the yurt? Well, what other competition do you have in this space?
I wouldn't say yurts are
a
competition, honestly,
no?
Because it's just like they're so different now. Like we've moved away from yurts. I would say it's like, you know, modular homes.
Interesting.
Because that's what we are technically. We are a modular home. It's just so different. We look so different. But, you know, Blue Homes, Island, there are a lot of companies that manufacture homes modularly. So it's not the same as a prefab home. They're much nicer. They're like really nice homes that they put in the factory. And they're just like amazing at manufacturing. So they cut costs pretty well. I've still managed to right now come down, like I'm cheaper than them. And, you know, and the quality is, it's up to the customer to decide, but it's like a totally different offering. It's like fireproof and moldproof and all that kind of thing, and it's circular, so it's like it's just different. You either love it or you look at it and you're like, I'm not gonna live in that. You know,
right.
which is totally fine.
You're not in the middle usually.
I'm not in the middle. Yeah, but that's our biggest competition is kind of other modular home buildings.
What do you see as the future of this space, modular homes? Is this something that most people are kind of unaware of, but it's going to be on the rise in the next, you know, 10, 20 years, especially in this housing crisis? Yeah,
exactly. I think it's really already on the rise, and I think it's going to keep getting bigger. You know, they used it in the Freethink piece as an example of like, yeah, if you had to manufacture, if you had to build your car individually, it would be impossible for all of us to own cars. But the fact that we have these assembly lines and we're building cars in assembly lines allows us. So there is just such an advantage to standardization on assembly lines. And that's what we're essentially doing is we're taking a bunch of the home building aspect to standardize assembly lines and then keeping other things customized that would suit a customer's needs. So the cost is significantly less. Like right now in Northern California, but it depends where, right? Like I'm coming in at about $300 a square foot now, completely built in the ground, like finished, like with everything, just like built in the ground.
Yeah.
In some places still in Northern America, that would be kind of like, all right, that's kind of upscale. Maybe I like it. I'm not sure. In other places like in California or Sedona, Arizona, or other kind of expensive places, you basically can't touch. No contractor will touch your site but without like maybe $800 to $1,000 a square foot.
Whoa.
That's where it's at. Post-COVID, everything's
I didn't know it got that.
It did, yeah. Everyone's surprised at how expensive things get until you actually start to build it. So there's that. And then there's also the experience, right? Like contractors are – it's kind of like, you know, they're the butt of jokes in the same way lawyers are. It's just like they're infamous for being like a hated group of people. I don't think because inherently there's something wrong with it, but there's something about that job that lends itself to – dishonesty and like
you just feel like you're getting screwed even if you're not
you always feel that way because it's like because their tendencies can do so they're always like yeah sure we can do that and then it always ends up taking twice as long and being five times as expensive so I have this experience in my house now because I had a lot of contract work done here where I have this like love-hate relationship. I like things but everything I'm looking at I'm like, oh, I remember you cost me eight times as much and you're still not working well. you know, the water is still cold, or like whatever. I'm just like, I'm constantly having this like traumatic experience in my house of like everything I overpaid for and got screwed on.
It's still not working.
It feels the same way. Yeah. It's like an awful relationship. Whereas with this, it's like there's really no surprises. Like there's, or the surprises have been really minimized. Like there's just a matter of like the earthwork and adjusting your property. But other than that, it's the building's going to cost exactly what you paid for. You're not going to pay a cent more. And it's going to be the exact same amount of time to build it every time. That's a really big deal. And the fact that I can actually have it all up in 30 days, that's unheard of. Most things are like a year out or a year and a half. But in 30 days, you can go from raw land. I mean, the permitting is a different issue, but you can go from permits in hand to living in it in like 30 days. That's pretty cool.
That's insane. Yeah, that's really well done. And no small feat, to say the least.
Thank you. Yeah, it hasn't felt like a small feat. Yeah.
Well, give me the process then, I guess, from the moment someone says, hey, I love this idea, I'd love to have it in my area. How do we go about from that to them living in the home?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So basically, the process would go, they would pay us kind of $1,000 refundable deposit as kind of an earnest money for us to go deeper into the conversation. Obviously, we're happy to talk to people but kind of to commit our engineering resources or actually go out and see their lot of land that they have in mind, we need a little bit of kind of earnest money. So they pay a $1,000 refundable deposit, and then we go out and see the lot that they want and discuss their vision with them. So that they want an 800 square foot one, 500, they want a couple attached together. And we look at the lot, and then we give them a full quote based on their actual property, because we're going to develop it for them. So we tell them how much the land work is going to cost, the septic system, or whatever it is they need. And then they decide what they want to do themselves and what they want us to do. We're not allowing other people to build our homes yet. That's coming in the future. Right now, we need to build them, but they can do whatever other work they want, foundation, or they can let us do it for them. And that happens. And then they have a choice. Either they can take from us the engineering drawings and go get their own permitting, like do their own permitting and submittal and stuff, or they can let us do it for them for $5,000. Which is like under the market rate right now for a consultant or someone to go in and take a full permitting and draw up a permitting set architecturally and do it for you. So we come right around or right under the market price, at least in California. And then we
do. And this is anywhere in the US, by the way. You can do this anywhere in the US, or is it just California for now?
No, anywhere. Not just the US, North America, South America. We have a couple of customers in South America. Yeah. Yeah. We have some people in Australia and Europe that are interested, but we haven't kind of locked it in yet. But the beautiful thing is a Zome takes basically a regular, less than a container size. So it can go anywhere.
I'm interested in the whole, in the Europe thing specifically, because I'm here now. And to me, it seems like, you know, with big cities and apartments, having this kind of structure, I don't know where you would put it. It would have to be on the outskirts or some kind of distant location, right?
I agree. Yeah.
So I'm curious what the European customer looks like, you know?
Yeah, me too. I'm really curious about that. Honestly, words are starting to kind of like spread, and we're starting to get some kind of interest in places. It is incredibly versatile. It can stay really warm. It's completely obviously waterproof. It is. So yeah, there are a lot of places that I think will become more interested. We're getting better at making it. At first, we were totally overpriced and we were making it too small. Now we have a 500 and an 800 square foot model, which are much bigger and actually quite livable, because the 800 square foot model, that's a
800
footprint.
Is a lot. Yeah.
But it has a floor and a half. So it's basically 1,000 square feet.
That's huge. Yeah.
So 1,000 square feet in the ground for $350,000 is actually pretty decent. I mean, in North America, and I don't know about Europe. So we'll have to keep adjusting our prices for different places, but we are getting better and more efficient at making it. And if the price keeps going down and we become more efficient, then I think more and more places other than North America it'll start making more sense there, you know?
It's a really interesting idea. Where do you see it going from, you know, 5, 10, 20? What's the big goal for you? Going forward.
Yeah, honestly, on a personal note, I just like this being a family business. I'm not actually like, I'm not like hungry for hunger's sake or just want to grow for growth's sake. I actually don't want to do that. That's not like.
But don't you have investors or people that you have to please?
Or
no, you don't.
Yeah, I know.
Interesting. That's really great.
We have
good
investors in certain projects that we're developing, which is awesome. So yeah. They're like short-term rental properties in Sedona, Arizona, and in California that like we're building Zomes and we're going to like short-term rent them or something. So that's great. We have investors there that are unique to this, but the company's owned by us and it's ours. And yeah, we want it to be a family business. I want the people who work in it now to be the people who work in it in 20 years. And, you know, it's not like as 100% efficient or cutthroat as it can be, but it's like a family and people feel a sense of loyalty and like confidence that this is happening and, you know, make us make good money for myself and my family and my brother and his family. And that's it. That's all I actually really want.
You're not really concerned about, you know, in 5 years, cutting it down to this price point and getting to 4 continents and, you know, all this other stuff. taking over the world in modular home design.
I'm totally open and responding to that, but I'm a little bit exhausted by my own. I've heard myself repeat these words so much. Things like disrupting industries and like and impacting the environment and that kind of stuff.
Yes, a thought leader.
Exactly. I thought, of course, you know, of course, because you can't just think, have a thought. You need to lead. Yeah. I'm a little bit exhausted of my own bullshit. So it's not that this stuff is all bullshit, my own bullshit to it. I'm a little tired.
I get what you're saying.
So I'm taking a break from kind of trying to change the world. And I'm just trying to kind of like do good by my customers, do good by my family, do good by people, build something I'm proud of, build something my kids can look at and be like, yeah, my dad built that. That's pretty cool. You know? And just kind of feel, my world has gotten smaller in some ways and it feels okay for now as before kind of, I imagine it might grow big again or whatever happens, but that's kind of where I'm at. But we're also responding, right? People are starting to get really interested and really hungry for it. People want to develop it really big. So I'm definitely going to be responsive to that, but I'm not like shooting for the moon.
In terms of, you know, reaching out to more people and getting this, let's say making content about it, making people more knowledgeable about it, what are your plans in terms of that kind of stuff? Because it's still a relatively niche idea. I'm sure like 90% of people that are listening don't even know what the hell we're talking about.
We're talking about, I would say 90, so it's like, probably 99 people, people are listening.
So how do you plan to like kind of educate people in the future about this project?
Excellent question. Yeah, we had a big kind of like PR and marketing and kind of image push at the beginning, and I think I just came back a little bit, retreated a little bit into just kind of like proficiency. I want to get my kind of marketing business school got ahead of me a little bit, and I started marketing a lot more than I was capable of. So I think right now I'm just really interested in building the perfect product and being super confident with it, and then watching that kind of like grow, which is kind of happening in parallel now, because I think we are much closer to the perfect product now. We have the right sizes, we have the right material, we have the right process, we have the right price. So now I am kind of like, you know, Freethink came up, I'm talking to you now, I'm kind of more open to just starting to kind of like boast and talk and just like get engaged with people around it now that I feel a lot more confident in what we have.
How many of these have you built already? Or how many customers have you had?
Yeah, we have about 30 plus customers, and we've built four so far with, you know, a dozen under construction.
Interesting. I'm a little curious as to why, like, I don't know. I mean, if you've built four of them, let's have some content. Get some YouTubers in that house, take some cool angles.
I know,
angles,
that was totally the initial idea as well. I think we will. Yeah, we will. But like I said, these ones were like, you know, these I built for a customer in their place. But right now we're doing our own kind of short-term rental properties. So these will be ours to kind of like open to the public and actually have people, you know, I'll give it up to kind of like content creators to come up and stay in and that kind of thing.
I think that's your like a big push on YouTube. I've seen a video on like yurts that had like 500,000 views. Some guy living in the middle of nowhere with his yurt and
absolutely
some nice B-roll footage. You know, like that's all it takes.
Absolutely, I'm totally gonna get over my own kind of like whole thing about social media right now and get into it at some point. But yeah,
you gotta dance with the devil a little bit sometimes.
I know, exactly. Well said.
Unfortunately.
Perfect analogy. Yeah, exactly.
Kareem, we talked about a lot of cool things about your business, about yourself. We're close to an hour, but I think I asked you kind of everything I wanted to. Anything else that you're working on that you want to promote? Plug.
Oh, thanks for asking. No, I mean, Zomes is all I'm passionate about right
Zomes
now.
Zomes it. Yeah, I'll leave a link down below. I'm sure you're going to eventually make content. I know you have a YouTube channel, but you haven't uploaded anything too crazy with Zomes. So hopefully one day we'll see more of that.
That will start.
Beautiful. Thank you for being a guest. I appreciate your
Thank
time.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate the conversation. It was genuinely interesting to me. Thanks.